Spectrum Business works with small businesses nationwide, so we know that running your own business means doing it all. Marketing, sales, inventory, customer service, and more. Spectrum One for Business helps you keep it all connected for just $49.99 a month. Get fast, reliable internet, advanced Wi-Fi with Security Shield, and a free mobile line for one low price. Stay connected and do it all with Spectrum One for Business. Only $49.99 a month. Go to spectrum.com/business to learn more. Restrictions apply. Services not available in all areas.
The NBA playoffs are here, and with FanDuel, your group chat's about to be going off. Because right now, new customers can bet $5 to get $150 in bonus bets if you win. And with live bets, your heart emojis will really be racing from tip-off to the final buzzer. Plus, when you win, you'll get paid faster than your friends can send you a victory gif. Or is it GIF? Who cares? You won! So get the word out to your crew and download FanDuel today. New customers bet $5 to get $150 in bonus bets if you win. Make every moment more with FanDuel, America's number one sports book. Official partner of the NBA.
21 plus and present in Ohio. First online real money wager only. $10 first deposit required. Bonus issued is non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire 7 days after receipt. See full terms at FanDuel.com/sportsbook. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
The most exciting part of a vacation stay at a home rental? Easy. It's being greeted upon arrival with a rusted lockbox affixed to the underside of a stranger's condo. Yeah, you simply twist knobs, click gears, jiggle it, and then rip it off its moorings, and voila! Your prize is a key to a questionable home rental and maybe tetanus. When you just want to get your vacation started by actually getting into your room, it matters where you stay. At Hilton, we deliver your key right to your phone on the Hilton Honors app. Hilton, for the stay.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Caribbean Studies. I'm Alejandra Bronfman. My guest today is Chelsea Stiber. She's the author of Haiti's Paper War, Post-Independence Writing, Civil War, and the Making of the Republic, 1804 to 1954. This book is a really new take on Haiti's 19th century. It's centered on writing as literature, as weapon, as essential to the making of memory. It takes us through new interpretive terrain that includes a critique of the prevailing racialist interpretations of Haitian political divisions. And it's just a good read. Here's our conversation. I hope you enjoy it. Chelsea, welcome, and thanks so much for joining me today.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start at the beginning. How did you get the idea that Haiti's Paper War was going to turn into a book?
I'd always hoped it would turn into a book. And that was definitely my plan. But it was, of course, when I finished my dissertation, and I had the good fortune of being able to take a year to really do more digging on that research that I'd done for my dissertation when I got a Kluge Fellowship at the Kluge Center at the Library of Congress. And that was just really fortunate for a number of reasons, but because I had a sense that I'd really, in my dissertation, found the beginnings of this sort of new regionalism that I made the case for in the book, and also the importance of these foundational sort of Civil War divisions. And I'd gotten that sense in my dissertation, but I needed to go back to the original foundational divisions and really do the reading of those sources that I had seen so contested and sort of relitigated as part of the late 19th century moment that I'd focused on in my dissertation. So when I was able to do that and really go back and then do the full long 19th century, that was when I was sure that that was what the book was going to be.
So I'm really interested in your method. It's part literary analysis and part close account of Haitian internal political conflicts. And I would love to hear you talk more about how you came to that as a method.
I suppose I'll take this opportunity also maybe to just situate myself more broadly as, I'd say, somewhat undisciplined, but in a very positive way, undisciplined interdisciplinarian. Because it shapes how I think about Haiti and how I use Haiti. And then obviously more broadly, this methodology that I elaborated. But from my background, I did my PhD in a joint program in French and Francophone literature, thought, and culture And then with that, this French studies sort of sociology, history, politics program. And so really part of that was for me a really necessary education or de-education in sort of the French universalist myth. And I have to chuckle right now because it's so in the news in the moment right now in France, if I'm not sure if you follow it, but or really anyone who listens. But it's really important because currently French academics and frankly U.S. academics by association are under fire from the French government for bringing these theories of critical race studies and of sort of inequality into the sort of sphere of French higher education and research, social science research. So, but all of that to say, you know, this interdisciplinary PhD was so challenging because it brought so many different regions and different methodologies together. But for me, Haiti became so clearly an answer, but also the problem, the productive, the good problem. There's a wonderful quote from the Haitian intellectual Louis-Joseph Janvier from the late 19th century, who says that Haiti is an argument that disturbs. And it is. And so for me, coming to, even just to Haiti more broadly in this interdisciplinary program was about finding a place that offered what Walter Mignolo calls the darker side of Western modernity. It offered sort of this story that challenged this universalist grand narrative of France. And so that's sort of my positionality and how and why I think through Haiti and with Haiti and how that fits. But insofar as this book, it was really essential for me to, and it becomes really the main argument of the first three chapters, to think and really challenge what we mean, we scholars mean when we talk about literature and what it is and what is literariness. And for me, it was so essential because it was in construction in this early moment in the 19th century, the concept itself, which is not something that I had originally sort of been aware of as I was engaging in Caribbean and Haitian literary production. And so for me, by being able to sort of suspend that concept as sort of a truth or really even as a hardened and defined concept, I was able to sort of go back and look at the way that writing itself was politically motivated or politically cast as either pure literary autonomous production on the part of authors or as engaged political production that was challenging both internal divisions, civil war divisions within the country, but also sort of external narratives and images and ideas of Haiti as a kind of place and of a kind of people at the same time. So, yeah.
So the just to get into that a little bit more, the book opens and then in some ways it follows the long 19th century thread, the long, long 19th century thread of two conceptions of liberty or liberté, right? So what are those?
Oh, the two conceptions of liberté, right, that I lay out in the introduction then sort of trace through. Well, again, this is just getting back to this idea of a sort of Republican, colorblind, liberal notion of individual rights, of individual property, of a sort of progress-based, and again, I'm putting these in air quotes, civilization that is defined by a dominant Western conception in the 19th century. And so there's that one notion of freedom that I associate with the Southern Republic and that sees itself really as the place where, if not all of the sort of European sort of revolutionary fervor of the Age of Revolution, but most certainly France's liberal revolution, the Southern Republic in Haiti, believes that it is the place and casts itself as the place where that spirit, and there's all sorts of literature around the spirit of liberty coming to Haiti. That's where it can continue to sort of thrive when its light has gone out in Europe. And so that's a one side. And then the other side is a concept of liberty that is really not recognizable from that Western dominant discourse. It's a liberty that requires a sort of a collective family underneath a single ruler, Dessalines, in the revolutionary period and the post-independence period, and that contests this Western idea of individual property and of sort of progress-based civilizational metrics to measure what belonging to the family of nations would look like.
So just to pick up on that and to continue, and you hinted at this a little bit, the literary scenes and the different kinds of writing are very kind of clearly articulated in the book. And you make the point that it's not just about the content that sort of distinguishes what happens in the North and in the South, but actually how the texts get written. So there's a kind of more collective writing that you argue goes on in the North. And then, I mean, to sort of put maybe unnuanced descriptions of these, and a kind of more individualistic kind of writing that goes on in the South. And that those are kind of weaponized at the same time. So what are examples of those that we can hang on to?
Yeah. And actually I want to even, because I make the point in the book, but I think it's even important to make a finer point here. What I see, it is a division of the way that sort of writing is conceived in literature or literariness, but the South is absolutely also performing this in some ways collectively, politically, to achieve this goal of Republican hegemony, Republican survival in the Atlantic world, but also against the North. And so it tends to get assimilated so easily, this Republican writing, into, or naturalized even, into a sort of longer history of like the history of Haitian literature, or of even sort of maybe Francophone writing more broadly. But it is a very deliberate political and performed stance that they're taking. To examples that we could hold on to, one would be sort of the sung poetry of commemoration or celebration of events that get published in the Gazette of the Northern State. It's first the Gazette of the state and then of the kingdom when the North becomes a kingdom under Henri Christophe. But we even see those under Dessalines as well. And so there are these... they're sung poems. They were written, I mean, a lot of them are signed, although not all of them are signed, in order to be, right, to be commemorative and to sort of show in print a much wider experience that happened on the ground during these commemorations. Whereas in the South, and especially as I show in the later sort of specialized periodicals in the late 18-teens, you have a lot of sort of more individual ideas of writing, of singular autonomous poetry. But even then, again, I think this conception of autonomous writing is also what they're doing in their literary criticism, which is itself sort of a concept that is emergent in this early period as well, of what it means to be a good writer. It means to be inspired by your own talents and your own heart. Instead of, and they make this very clear, the Southern writers, instead of, for example, being told to write a commemorative poem by the monarch. And they see that as sort of a fundamental distinction between their project and the project of the North.
So in some ways, the literature circles around the Dessalines and his assassination. I found that it haunts the book throughout, right? It just keeps coming up, coming back again and again, and getting reformulated, reinterpreted, recast. What was the decision to make that so central? Was it just kind of jumping out at you everywhere? I'm curious.
Yeah, that is a, you're picking up on something. I found that it not only was not apparent in the beginning, and then it became this inevitable sort of through line. That is so powerful for me because it is. It's this right. It's not something I sought out to sort of show, and yet it continues to come back again and again. And I think it's part of really this foundational. I hesitate to call it a fracture because I don't want to make it a necessarily you know, irreparable division, or something that, you know, was coherent and then broken. Nevertheless, this really, I think, from the foundation of the independent state of Haiti, with the Armée Indigène that Dessalines led during the revolution, there is within it, within, and I show this in the first chapter, within all of the writing that he is having put out, right, these commemorative poems, but also, you know, his declarations and so on, there is the awareness of the sort of radical newness of what he's doing as a state project, but also the quite numerous and powerful a group of pro-Republican army generals who do not agree with his state formation. And so his assassination is sort of part of this longer tension that is foundational to the nation. And so it seems so natural to me, you know, having gone back and really done this long 19th century work, that it would continue to haunt, to sort of surge forth, to be unable to really be confronted, because it is so, I mean, I don't want to sort of psychoanalyze, but it is so repressed in so much of the early writing of the post-Civil War period, 1820 on.
Well, part of the reason for that, I guess, is what I gathered from the book, and what I thought you treated really carefully and beautifully and thoughtfully, is the violence, right? I mean, the fact of his assassination and the fact of the violence that was necessary to undertake that, and the justification of that sort of under a kind of Republican, you know, cloak, right? Mm-hmm. So I was really really fascinated by that, and I guess I'm just wondering how that all falls out. Like, what do we do with that?
Yeah. It is absolutely necessary to confront the violence both of the revolution itself, the violence of colonialism and enslavement, the violence of what is so fraught and debated in terms of Dessalines' decision and feeling of necessity to kill the remaining French on the island for fear of re-enslavement or of an inevitable French attempt to retake the island, which did, of course, happen numerous times in the early post-independence period that culminated with the forced indemnity payment in 1825 under Boyer. But so that violence is absolutely, you know, incontrovertible and sort of throughout the writing of the period. But the violence of Dessalines' assassination is, especially in this early Republican writing, absolutely both naturalized in the sense that it's becomes this metaphor. I think this is what you're referring to in your question. This metaphor of sort of a natural disaster that Republican writers sort of have to find a way to navigate it would be interesting for me to do a little bit more of a psychoanalytical reading of it. I mean, I find that that especially those early renderings are fascinating to think through in that way. But even just in thinking about their strategic positioning, these Republicans in this post-Civil War period, what they're looking to do is to continue to project an idea of Haiti that is, again, in air quotes, civilized, which means that they can, you know, continue to engage in trade and in diplomatic relations with other great nations, again, in quotes, of the Atlantic world. And so it's important for them not to sort of engage in violent rhetoric. And Dessalines, of course, is, and as I show in the book, violent rhetoric is a central part of his political and we could call it cultural idea for creating an independent Haiti. And so they're both, it's fraught, and they're both confronting what it means to project this image for very strategic reasons, because that is the path that they have chosen, and that is what they believe is the most effective way to create lasting independence. And this, the reality of that violence.
It's really fascinating to watch you draw out those lines of argument. And another thing that I found interesting that took me by surprise towards the end was the way that you get to the critique, implicit initially and then not so implicit more towards the end, is of the critique of the kind of racialist interpretations of Haitian history, I guess mostly in the hands of David Nichols, who you mention and then sort of argue against. So can you talk us through that a little bit? What's wrong with the racialist interpretation and what do we replace it with? And I have to sort of preface that by saying that it doesn't come up until the end of the book. I mean, you write it in, but not explicitly until the very end of the book. And then I had to sort of go back and thought, oh wow, talk to us more about that.
Yeah, that's I'm happy to be able to also point to other people who are doing really exceptional work there too. So, I mean, yeah, David Nichols, Marlena Doubt has, and I refer to her in the book, really was for me a crucial person to think with, because she has pointed this out at length and has a really good discussion of the problems with David Nichols' interpretations of Haitian history, the way that he writes about Haitian history. So I would encourage any listener to also look to her writing for that especially. But more recently as well, Jean Casimir, who is a really probably the leading Haitian scholar. He's just written a book. Well, it's a translation that just came out actually with UNC of a book he wrote in 2018 called The Haitians, A Decolonial History. And he has, I think, an even more rigorous and just sort of mind-blowing reading of the racialist interpretation of Haitian history as well. So I'm not dodging, but I want to point to those really fundamental works that are doing this sort of deeply. When you're saying it came in at the end and then you kind of look back, that was a strategic decision that I made to not refer to the actors that I was chronicling and looking at these Civil War divisions according to racial, assigning a race to them or to put them in a sort of a color category. In order to let other differences sort of come forth, or in order to highlight the other differences that are essential to understanding these Civil War divisions. It is just simply not true, as Marlena Doubt argues, that you can make sense or sort of assign political agency based on color in Haitian history. And so, yes, it was a strategic choice insofar as I wanted to show the different sort of political realities of these divisions, of these divided concepts of the post-independence Haitian state, in order to allow them to sort of breathe outside. And again, Nichols has been so dominant in sort of explaining the noiriste, and that's an anachronism, frankly, of interpretation of the past versus a mulâtre. In quotes, interpretation of the past. It is indeed infinitely more complicated than that. So what do you replace it with? I mean, I would hope that my book has at least offered a much more capacious and pluralistic understanding of regional difference, of sort of those filiations that are much more based in the lived experience of these very different, very separate regional realities. But there are any number of other divisions as well. And it's not as if I'm arguing to replace one with another, and it's also not as if I'm arguing that there isn't the lived experience of colorism and racial difference within Haiti, but that my hope was to allow, to take off the filter that David Nichols and others, but I would place it more on him, have sort of put on to looking at the past in order to think more capaciously. And again, I think Jean Casimir has a way of putting that that same sentiment, frankly, into words that I would encourage others to read.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
If you're an athlete, you know the greatest motivator of all is the fear of letting your teammates down. After all, a team is only as good as its weakest link. So you owe it to those wearing the same jersey as you to be your best every time you step on the field. That's why there's no vape in team. When you vape, you can expose your lungs to toxic chemicals that can damage your lungs. If you're a step behind, the team's a step behind. Brought to you by The Real Cost and the FDA.
So just to complicate that a little bit more, so you write that about Boyer and the way that Haiti's kind of finally unified more or less under him. And that's where the literary connections kind of turn to the peasantry and to an African heritage, as in the work of somebody like Ignace Nau. I know I'm butchering these names, so I'm sorry. So why did the sort of connections to an African heritage come up then? And what are the legacies of that?
This is the connection to an African legacy within the Southern Republican tradition, frankly. There are absolutely great examples of Northern writers highlighting Haiti's African connections. And this is from the, you know, the foundational writing of Dessalinian independence through Henri Christophe's kingdom. So what Boyer is doing is yoking sort of a Republican idea of the Haitian state, then these writers who are coming in under this Republican tradition to reactivate or sort of bring Haiti's, the realities of an African diasporic past to within this Republican tradition. Mm-hmm. And for me, that is a contestation. And it's you know, with these writers that I look at in the late 1830s, and I kind of call them a loosely organized group. You have some people who are quite affiliated with Boyer's presidency, but then you have others who are troublemakers and who are really trying to contest his power, so to speak. And so I see, and this is the poem that you're referring to, that again Dessalines comes back in such a powerful way, of thinking about a more capacious idea of what Haitianness, what it means to be Haitian under this Republican government, and also as part of a island-wide definition of what it means to be Haitian, right? Because this is during the period where Boyer had unified, in quotes, or invaded the East to create this singular Republic of Island Haiti. And so you have these writers who are challenging. They're challenging sort of an idea of what it means to be Haitian. They're trying to expand it to include an Amerindian, a Taino legacy, also a African diasporic legacy of enslavement and sort of rupture from the African homeland to the Caribbean. And then also the connections that might make to the East. They don't make too many connections with Spain, for example, and sort of that legacy, but they do make connections with the Amerindian sort of shared past from the East and the West. And so for me, that, you know, that's an attempt to challenge Boyer, who is so, you know, certain that sort of unity, Haitian unity, is the way to sort of, with a tight fist, kind of keep the nation together and to have an ability to survive sort of in the increasingly hostile Atlantic world to Haiti. But they're challenging it by demanding or offering different ways of thinking about Haitianness that are much, much wider and much broader than had been in Republican writing to that point.
So towards the end, there's a really fascinating discussion of Suluk. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right. And the role of art and visual culture. And you're really rewriting the historiography on Suluk, which I completely admit I fell victim to. You know, I've come across him in accounts of Haitian history and thought, oh, you know, some crazy dictator, right? Like some crazy, but it's really, really fascinating what you do with him. And so talk about the relationship of art and visual culture to that moment.
Oh, it was one of my, you know, I'll be honest, it was one of the harder chapters for me to write because it is different, right? I'm doing something different, but it ended up being my favorite one. I don't know if that's most people's experiences or what, but, you know, it was sort of like the tough one that I was always sort of trying to work through. And then it ended up just finally kind of at the end when I was really finishing the manuscript, turning into this, what I really think is one of my favorite chapters, although I like them all, couldn't ever really pick, but yeah. But so, yeah, and I want to give a shout out to a couple people who are working on Suluk right now that I think will really even do more, which I'm super excited about. Gaëtan Monteau, who is a Haitian scholar, is working on a biography, and there is a Yale just passed his PhD. Who is going to be doing a really amazing, who did an amazing book on Suluk and who's going to continue to do really interesting stuff with that. So I'm just going to get his name. I don't want to get his name wrong because that would be Emmanuel Lachaud. And he's coming out of Yale and he just did a great work on Suluk. So there's more stuff coming and that is very exciting because I think there's more that needs to come. But so for me, what was really important was to think about, and this gets back into the sort of divisions I'm seeing with literature, literariness, critique, and civilization, in air quotes, as these concepts that are sort of the dominant Western concepts that are contested in the Dessalinian tradition and under Suluk. And so on the one hand, you know, visual culture is central to a monarchy. His empire, you know, presidency turned empire, was absolutely based in the pomp and the sort of performance of power. And again, I hope it's challenging not to appear as a monarchist, I suppose. But I think it's very. I hope I've made clear. It's clear to me that these are challenges. These are critiques of a. Sort of, again, a Western conceptualization of republicanism and of liberty that is exclusionary of Black men and women, diasporic in the Caribbean. And so visual culture becomes a way to sort of perform monarchy, but also to sort of be more inclusive of a peasant-based or a non-sort of educated elite-based you know, majority of the country. But so that's like the one side of it, right? That I see sort of his emphasis, not so much on writing. And of course, there was a newspaper published under Suluk the whole time that he was president and emperor. There is writing that happens, but it's just not the emphasis, right? His emphasis is not what the emphasis of, say, Boyer was. Boyer was so singularly focused on performing and disseminating and making visible and visual to the outside world this idea of Haiti as a certain way. And for Suluk, he's much more interested in challenging, essentially, that dominant sort of idea to which Boyer was aspiring and critiquing it. And so the visual culture that I've sort of, I mean, I of course allude to the reality of sort of lived the lived experience under Suluk, or at least the use of visual culture there. But then obviously he's playing, this critique comes in at the way that he chooses to represent himself in this Western world. And it's, of course, in exact dialogue with and refutation of these just outrageous caricatures that are circulating and that had circulated, frankly, since Dessalines, you know, these representations of, you know, despots in the West and how, you know, they were so uncivilized and how it was such a travesty. And of course, these caricatures were also being used to within France to critique Napoleon. So there's all these different agendas at work. And so Suluk plays with that. And he also sort of has his response. And it's a very, I think it's a brilliant one, which is to use sort of this sophisticated practice of photography and lithograph to present himself to the outside world as such.
So the last two chapters take us to the 20th century. And why was that important to you? Why was it important to extend it on into these periods that are so often sort of closed off from the 19th century?
The long, long 19th century. for a number of reasons. But I think the main one is that I think a lot of sort of writing and thinking about Haiti starts in 1915. With the U.S. occupation of Haiti and sort of the early, and I'm putting that in quotes, writers of sort of the Revue Indigène, Jacques Houma, and a lot of the sort of more, I would argue, well-known Haitian writers from that period. But, and also, so that's, you know, sort of, I wanted to extend it back, but really show it as part of a continuation of this longer history. But also, I hope I've made clear, some really new debates and new conceptualizations of sort of a more Port-au-Prince-centric understanding of the organization of Haitian space and of the state. But another much simpler answer is that that's actually where I started. Mm-hmm. I started at the end of the 19th century when I was doing my dissertation work. And I understood it so intimately that it was such a good place to be able to come back to. I had to sort of fight the urge to make everything fit into what I saw in the 19th century. And I think I succeeded in that. There's a lot of ambiguity, and there are these continuations of trends that we see, but they're sort of manifested in different ways, in different regions, but also in different writers. It was necessary for me to draw that connection because there is a continuity as well. And what had brought me into this whole idea of going back to these original foundational tensions and the Civil War was that I had seen in literary magazines and newspapers from non-Port-au-Prince centric sources that no one had read, or very, very few people had read, these completely different understandings of what Haiti was, what it looked like, what their lived experience was. And of course, I'm talking about, you know, elite intellectuals, but ones that, you know, were engaging with the outside, the peasantry outside of their, you know, second city or their non-capital port city, in ways that were very different. In fact, I also realized that a lot of the ideas about Haiti in the 20th century, you know, the writing that we see coming from these indigenistes, et cetera, was not very representative of much at all in some ways. I mean, I'm thinking about, again, La Revue Indigène, which I think a lot of Caribbean studies folks know as a really important publication. And for me, sort of realizing that it was designed and written in a lot of ways for mostly an outside audience. It was a very young elite intellectual production. And so, yeah, so really kind of rerouting or setting the stage for the late 19th, early 20th century with the understanding of this fraught, extremely diverse, plural sort of reality of the 19th century, that to me would allow a much more capacious and really nuanced, messy understanding of the early 20th century that I think has been not essentialized, but really sort of reduced to a few intellectual actors.
Yeah. And yeah, you suggest towards the end in a very subtle way that what you're doing is creating a kind of alternative path through which to understand Duvalierism. Mm-hmm. Or are you going to say that? what is that path and how do we understand that?
Oof, yeah, it's an essential question today as the political situation in Haiti is also certainly fraught, undemocratic, and frankly resurrecting or at least rhyming with some of the Duvalierist tendencies. So it's a real question, and it's one that has consequences, I think, today. Duvalierism is and remains such a violent and challenging. I mean, I hesitate to put words to it because, first of all, it's not in the book, but also because it is such a violent and terrible part of Haiti's history. But to attribute sort of Duvalierism simply to Haiti's, revolutionary past and the fact that Dessalines, became emperor and that Suluk was evil dictator. I'm not sure if that's exactly what you said, but was another dictator, right? Is to attribute sort of a teleological reading, frankly, but also a sort of complicity of, say, Dessalines or Suluk or Salnav or any of the other leaders who did not perform this one version of liberty as sort of individual property and individual liberty as being the cause of Duvalierism, and not, say, for example, the U.S. and its extreme anti-communist politics and its sort of role in shaping the Caribbean during that period, or in its intervention during the U.S. military occupation. And that's just like one example of one other, important and necessary sort of external actor to think about. But additionally, I mean, and this is the subtle argument that comes through in the end is exactly that what Dessalinian thought offers is a critique of an idea or of sort of a notion of Western modernity as liberating, as civilizing, but it's not a refusal. It's not it's not fascism. It's not, it is, again, it's a critique. It's a holding up of a mirror. Undeniably, there are physical violences and state violences that occur, but they occur under every president, putatively Republican or not. This sort of easy explanation for Duvalierism by looking at quote unquote dictators of the past is a way to sort of foreclose other reflections on what powers, what inequalities, what forces, internal and external, sort of cohered or came together to allow for the rise of Duvalierism as a phenomenon and as a dictatorship and as a state sort of run violence. And I certainly don't offer an answer. And there are plenty of people who are doing excellent work on Duvalierism itself. But what I hope to show is a very different stage setting for that period than simply sort of an inevitable march toward, dictatorship.
Well, it seems like what you're also doing is kind of rewriting the things that he actually claimed as his heritage, right? Mm-hmm. So, and I think that's really important. So last question, what are the implications? And you mentioned this just a little bit for Haitians today. How would you like them to read your book?
It is absolutely an honor to be able to work on Haiti. And I hope they read my book with an understanding of that is what I am coming to, with it. But I sort of say this at the end of the book, and I'd mentioned this in the beginning, that I don't mean it as a sort of an accusation against anyone, but a recognition that sort of everyone has a use of Haiti to an extent. certainly scholars who work on Haiti too. And I hope that they read it with an understanding that I am trying to do it in the most nuanced way. I don't want to write a book that is a monolithic book. I don't want to write a book that is sort of extractive. You know, I've written in a way that I hope is illustrative of the plurality of Haiti's long, long 19th century. And I make this clear in the introduction as well. It's but one tiny sliver of that plurality. You know, my methodology and the works that I focused on, and precisely because I'm working on writing Paper War, I'm not writing about the lived experience of the mass of the inhabitants of the country. I hope that by offering sort of a much more engaged and in-depth presentation of the cultural, political realities and these regional differences and these tensions and uses of the long history with Haiti that various actors and politicians put into place, that it will also allow for people who are doing that work the post-colonial counter-plantation system and the lived experience of the majority of Haiti's inhabitants will also be rendered clearer, or that they will have a framework to work within too, that is not the David Nichols framework, or that is not the sort of framework that is the...
Thank you so much. I think that's a great place to end.
Okay. Excellent. Thanks very much for this opportunity for reading. It is truly a pleasure and an honor to be read. And so I thank you very much.
Likewise, just a total pleasure.
Thanks so much for listening, and see you next time.